3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your
pants. Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is the 14th of May. Good morning, Leela. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Yes, it is going. It's going. I think I always get a bit surprised, like the transition between daylight savings and then it getting cold and dark is really jarring. And I'm like, my body just doesn't, like my body's so tuned into the sun and seasons that the daylight savings shift, my body's just like, no.
It's hard.
I'm still recovering.
Yeah.
I spoke to my sister the other day and we were talking about sort of light and how you're supposed to see natural light as your first source of light every day, apparently, to help your brain consolidate the benefits of your sleep. And you have to wait, apparently, 2 hours before you look at artificial light. And I'm like, well, I'm out.
Wow.
I'm done.
I guess I will never have a good life.
Nope, me neither.
But that's like, you know... Is it a crime to wake up early, you know?
I
wake up early just because.
Yeah, I think waking up early in winter is actually really beautiful.
Yes, that's how we land on that. Let's all be like...
And I've discovered that thanks to 3CR.
Amazing. Let's all be like my yeah and wake up at 4 a.m. for no reason. So we have, as usual, a massive show, especially because this week's program comes in the wake of the announcement of Tuesday's federal budget for 2026-2027. And yes. So first up, we will be joined by Anti-Poverty Centre spokesperson Kristen O'Connell to unpack some of those measures announced in the budget with a disability and economic justice lens. And of course, while the budget speech really emphasized cost of living relief, this did not meaningfully extend to people living below the poverty line or on social security payments. And as we've discussed over previous weeks, cuts to the growth of the NDIS will have significant impacts on the disabled community around the country. So really keen to hear a bit more about how those measures will land. And then after that, we're going to listen to some speeches from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria's gathering outside Melbourne Town Hall this past Tuesday to amplify community opposition to the City of Melbourne's plan to expand its violent and exclusionary security patrols in the next financial year. Now, in this segment, you're going to hear from Rory of Vixen Workers talking about anti-homelessness measures in the city of Port Phillip. And then you'll also hear from Shifra from Footscray Community Response talking about the city of Maribyrnong's announcement that it was going to end its own security patrols, only to reveal that later that this would be replaced by an increased local police presence in the area.
Following that, we will be speaking with Yolanda Robson of Young Workers Centre. She's going to talk to us about the landmark campaign in collaboration with Youth Law that brought an end to junior pay rates for workers aged 18 to 20 in the retail, fast food and pharmacy sectors.
And after that, we will hear from... Sorry. We'll hear from Josephine Langbian to unpack last week's High Court dismissal of a legal challenge brought against the Albanese government in 2025, contesting the right to permanently exile refugees and stateless people to Nauru, which is currently still in place, with at least 6 people having been deported. So, yeah, I'm really curious to unpack that a bit more this morning and understand the details and what that case actually means for people who are facing deportation or currently in the appeal process.
And finally, we'll be joined by Shirley, who's the co-convener of No AUKUS Victoria and the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition Working Group, to talk about some updates in the campaign against the AUKUS partnership, including the establishment this year of an Australian Federal Police Command that is tasked specifically with targeting anti-AUKUS protests. And Shirley's also going to talk to us a bit about budget expenditure on AUKUS measures, as well as an upcoming webinar that's organised by the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition coming up on Wednesday, the 20th of May. Stay tuned. We are going to be with you all the way through to 8:30 a.m. You're listening to 3CR 855 a.m. and it's Thursday breakfast.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
Or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au. Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing?
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march and we say, yeah, nah.
Yen Up Us Iran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m. we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:08 in the morning, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 14th of May. Advocacy and community groups have condemned the federal budget handed down on Tuesday as cruel, saying the Albanese government is protecting corporate profits while failing to address poverty, housing affordability, disability supports, and climate change. $36 billion in cuts to the NDIS over 4 years will reduce access to essential supports for people with disabilities, causing immense harms, particularly to those living in poverty. Community groups also said that the government missed an opportunity to meaningfully reduce inequalities through housing and tax reform, including stronger measures to expand public housing. The budget will fail to lift income support payments above the poverty line, leaving many people on Centrelink payments struggling to meet basic living costs. Climate organisations have criticised the continuation of fossil fuel subsidies, with insufficient investment in renewable energy and climate action announced.
Also in news this week, a United Nations racial discrimination complaint has been lodged over the grossly disproportionate incarceration of First Nation children in so-called Australia, which has subjected children to cruel and inhumane treatment. The complaint comes after a UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination raised grave concerns about overrepresentation in detention, citing racial profiling, over-policing and harsh practices such as solitary confinement and spit hoods. First Nations children make up around 65% of those in detention, despite being 6.5% of the child population. Backed by human rights and First Nations bodies, including the Australian Human Rights Commission and CIDIAC, the National Voice for Our Children, the complaint calls for urgent intervention and argues recent so-called tough-on-crime laws in states including Victoria, Queensland and Northern Territory breach international human rights obligations.
In other news this week, The first climate case to reach the High Court was heard yesterday in a challenge to the approval of a major coal mine expansion in New South Wales. The decision could set a binding precedent on whether planning authorities must consider local climate impacts of fossil fuel projects. The case, brought by a Hunter Valley community group, follows a 2025 Court of Appeal ruling that found the mine's approval unlawful for failing to properly account for downstream emissions. Legal experts and advocates say the decision could have major implications for future fossil fuel developments across the country, as courts determine whether emissions from exported coal can be considered under domestic planning laws in the context of escalating climate impacts.
In other climate news, Greenpeace Australia Pacific has criticised Woodside's Browse gas proposal, calling the company's latest report, quote, self-serving tosh, end quote, and arguing it falsely claims the project would not affect emissions targets while ignoring its potential climate impact. The environmental group says the offshore gas development would significantly increase emissions and threaten Scott Reef in the Timor Sea, warning it would industrialise one of the last pristine reef systems.
Finally, in the headlines, Sudan's Buol Nine state has become the latest attacks in the conflict between the Sudan government and the Rapid Support Forces. More than 28,000 people have been forced from their homes in various parts of the Blue Nile state since January, in what continues to be the world's largest displacement and humanitarian crisis in the world. Rainy season is approaching, and people in displacement camps, including those living in temporary shelters and informal camps, are raising concerns that shortages of humanitarian assistance will mean that an already catastrophic situation will worsen in the coming days. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 14th of May. You listen to 3CR on 855 AM.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to three times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just coming up to 7:14 in the morning, and I am now joined by Kristen O'Connell, who is an Anti-Poverty Centre spokesperson and is speaking with us about some of the measures announced in Tuesday's 2026-27 federal budget from a disability and economic justice lens. Now, while Treasurer Jim Chalmers' budget speech emphasised cost of living relief, this did not extend to people living below the poverty line on Social Security payments. Significant changes to limit the growth of the National Disability Insurance Scheme were marketed as a considered choice to claw back government revenue, but disability advocates argue that these restrictions will have serious implications for disabled people's quality of life and access to supports. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Priya.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I understand that you've also had a bit of a hectic week in Canberra. Can you tell us a bit about what that's been like? What's the atmosphere been like for this announcement of a budget that Chalmers has really badged as making some landmark decisions that haven't been made in the past, you know, couple of decades?
It's always very demoralizing to be here, and especially in a week like this. I was at Parliament on Tuesday night near the rooms where all of the really people who've got all the access get to go and get the budget papers before the rest of us. And as the Treasurer was coming out to make his speech, watching staff walking in with bottles of wine and champagne, knowing that so many disabled people, including myself, are likely to lose access to the support we need, knowing that there was nothing coming, no support coming for people on the lowest incomes and nothing meaningful for people in paid work, even if they get the $200 tax offset. So it's pretty big gut punch to see the jubilation and the celebration and the self-congratulation, and then to see a wave of organisations that are supposed to stand up for the rights of poor and disabled people finding things to congratulate the government for, when the number one change in this budget that everybody should be talking about is the fact that the Albanese government wants a budget surplus off the backs of disabled people.
Thank you so much for framing it like that for us. I think it really sets the tone for some of the measures that we're going to unpack, and cuts against the grain of, as you said, a lot of the statements that have come out about the budget. And I know it's not just poor and disabled folks that are upset about how this budget has landed. There's been real concerns about its you know, its lack of attention to climate justice and to a variety of other really pressing concerns. I think a lot of the rhetoric in, you know, Jim Chalmers' budget speech was about carefully and responsibly stewarding the nation through a war that the Australian government insists adamantly that we have nothing to do with. And yet, the people that are going to be most affected by these budget decisions, as you said, are going to be the disabled community. So I wanted to ask you about those impacts of, you know, the limitation of the growth of the NDIS and that failure to listen to disabled communities' concerns over the past few weeks in particular, as people have been sounding the alarm around the country about how this cannot go forward.
Mm-hmm. I think important context for what's happening to the NDIS is that, one, we know that it was, the biggest victory I can think of, certainly in my lifetime, in terms of getting the government to establish a really significant and ambitious social support. And, of course, that happened under a Labor government. And Bill Shorten was crucial in securing the NDIS. We then saw, after the Albanese government came to power, Bill Shorten himself play a crucial role in undermining support for the NDIS and laying the foundation for the cuts that we are seeing in this budget. We have seen anti-autistic rhetoric from this government over many years now, and that has been intentionally designed to make sure that community attitudes towards autistic people specifically and disabled people more broadly shifted so that they could get away with a series of cuts like this. So this has been a long time in the making, and it's also not the first attack on the NDIS from this government. So they had wanted to do this. They have seen it as an easy way to save money because they don't want to constrain their spending on war and supporting genocide in West Asia. And so now we know that because they couldn't just reduce people's plan, they did try to cut my plan and the AAT reinstated it, that they are doing these sweeping changes so that they can kick people off en masse. So I think it is more than constraining the growth. I think it's more about, it is also going to include removing support from people entirely, not just changing the things that we're able to access. It's going to mean that people are less able to participate in society. That's it. At the end of the day, the NDIS was supposed to give us choice and control over our own lives and enable us to participate fully in society. It didn't achieve that. It was on its way. It needs change, but it doesn't need the change this government is pushing. And certainly, as you pointed out, there haven't been any disabled people involved in designing what this government is doing.
Yeah, and, you know, I appreciate you also bringing us back to the fact that language around limiting the growth of the scheme mm-hmm. deliberately deflects away from the material impacts that this will have on disabled folks' lives and on their ability to exercise just the basic aspects of self-determination and to live in a dignified way that mm-hmm. everybody else is. Now, there has been, as I mentioned before, a lot of talk about cost of living relief and mm-hmm. that, you know, little kickback that's coming to all working people, albeit, I think, from mid next year. But there was nothing mentioned about people living below the poverty line, though I did have a quick skim of the budget documents, and it is very interesting to know that there's still funding income management programs. So are there any measures that I've missed here, or are there just none?
There are literally none. And as you note, there has been a lot of talk about broken promises in this media cycle and class war. And both of those things are true in this budget, but it is not, in fact, a class war on rich people or a broken promise to those who are hoarding multiple homes. We have seen some of the worst broken promises include maintaining compulsory income control programs that primarily harm First Nations people, despite running an election campaign to get elected on the promise of getting rid of that program. And, of course, one of the other big promises of the Albanese government was to leave no one behind. And it's true that they're not leaving us behind. They are actively holding us back. They are punishing people for poverty. They're punishing people for unemployment at a time when the RBA is actively pursuing increased unemployment. So the government knows that people don't have a choice about whether or not there are enough jobs. They know that unemployment is going to go up. They know that we don't control the economic macroeconomic factors that determine whether there are jobs, and they do, but they're still refusing to support people. So there is no additional increase to any base Centrelink payment. There is no widespread increase to any supplement payment. There is one very targeted supplement payment just for a few thousand people to be given a top-up to community housing landlords. That will not go to the people living in those homes. It will go to the landlords who run them. And that payment will not see any additional low-income housing. It's just going to reward community housing landlords who have been discriminating against young people. So that is the extent of measures. There is a lot of claims that the changes to capital gains tax discounts and negative gearing are somehow going to benefit low-income people, and I have been saying it is always the right thing to do to reduce inequality, but it makes no difference to our lives if you don't spend it on the things we need, like mass investment in public housing, ensuring Centrelink payments are above the poverty line, and fully funding essential services like Medicare and public education.
Yeah, when you talk about broken election promises and class war, really the mainstream media headlines are, you know, plastered with the notion that these cuts are a broken promise to voters in terms of, you know, scrapping negative gearing for new properties mm-hmm. and reducing the capital gains tax discount, and that's a big issue of broken trust. But as you said, that is a very narrow framing, and in fact again it is about talking about a pact between the government and a particular class of the population that in effect perpetuates inequality for, you know, such a massive proportion of the population who, as you said, have no real benefits coming to them directly from this budget. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention about, you know, the way that this budget has landed or measures in it that you're particularly concerned about?
I just want to pick up on your last point there, and I guess, as you were talking, it occurred to me that when we're thinking about war, obviously, we're thinking about death and destruction, and there's not a single person who loses tax discounts who is going to die as a result of this budget, but there are a lot of poor and disabled people who will. And that is, at the end of the day, the thing that this budget has chosen over, I don't know, spending on social programs that might limit its ability to reach surplus in 4 years. I think in terms of other measures, look, there's not much to say. There's things that are missing, but we could make a laundry list of things that are missing. There is a small amount of money going into making sure that welfare compliance penalties continue to operate. That system of so-called mutual obligations was found to be operating unlawfully by the Commonwealth Ombudsman last year, and the government has kept it in place and is now putting a small amount of money into trying, I suppose, to make it operate lawfully. But we really haven't seen any spending to talk about. So, yeah, unfortunately, there's not much to say other than, I guess, solidarity to every person out there who is not getting the support that they need, who is struggling to access safe, secure, accessible and genuinely affordable housing, and who doesn't have enough money to live, because, unfortunately, things aren't, I think, likely to get better for any of us in the near term.
Yeah, it is extremely sobering to reflect on what this budget really means. Now, Kristen, I understand that Anti-Poverty Centre has an event coming up that you're going to be using to have a bit of a post-budget conversation. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we're going to get folks together online and go through some of the slightly too boring but important details that we wouldn't necessarily get into this morning, and also talk to people about what some of the announcements might mean in practice, the kinds of things we want to look out for that the government might do or might not do, because budget papers tell you some information, but they also leave a lot of question marks. And it's really now important for us all to be vigilant about where these decisions go. So that will be online, and people can find information and sign up for that. It's a free event, either via social media. It's been posted on our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and Blue Sky accounts. Or you can go to our Linktree, which is linktree.com/antipovertycent. That's linktr.ee/antipovertycent.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kristen, for all of the incredible work that you and Anti-Poverty Centre are doing to make sure that the government knows folks won't go quietly after this devastating hit in the 2026-2027 budget. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Priya.
And that was Anti-Poverty Centre spokesperson Kristen O'Connell, who was speaking with us about some of the measures announced in Tuesday's 2026 to 2027 federal budget, which has had some serious consequences, and I must say seriously negative consequences, for disabled folks around the country and people living below the poverty line, even though there has been a lot of rhetoric around the capital gains tax discount being reduced and negative gearing being scrapped for new properties, around cost of living relief measures. This leaves a lot of people behind, and in fact leaves a lot of people worse off. You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:28 in the morning.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. I'm going to do a little weather check before we head into our next segment for today. Now, it's been a sunny week, a nice change from last week's torrential rain, which I was not prepared for. Today, it's going to be a high of 21 degrees Celsius, a low of 8 degrees, not We're not expecting any rain. It's going to be sunny. And tomorrow will also be around the same conditions before we're back to rain on Sunday. So, you know, I'm always checking the Bureau of Meteorology app. This is not a paid promotion for the bomb, but I, you know, I recommend it. And then I also recommend once you've checked it to then prepare, because what I do is I check it and then I don't do anything about it. And then I complain when I'm caught in a storm. Now, we are going to our second segment for today. And we're going to listen to some speeches from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria's gathering outside Melbourne's Town Hall this past Tuesday to amplify community opposition to the City of Melbourne's plan in its draft budget for 2026 to 2027 to expand its violent and exclusionary security patrols. And this would expand them from 11 officers at the moment to 22. Now, in this segment, you're going to first hear Rory of Vixen Workers talking about anti-homelessness measures in the city of Port Phillip and their impacts on street-based sex workers. You're also then going to hear from Shifra of Footscray Community Response talking about the city of Maribyrnong's disingenuous announcement at the end of its own security patrols after a sustained community campaign, only to later reveal that this will be replaced by significantly increased local police presence in the area.
Hi, I'm Rory from Vixen. First, I want to acknowledge that we're all gathered here today on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people and the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded, never will be ceded. The genocide here is ongoing, and we know that all of this impacts First Nations unhoused people the most. They're the ones bearing the brunt, so I want to pay respects to any mob here today and pay my respects to elders past and present and my own elders and ancestors. Thank you. I'm here to talk about what's been happening in City of Port Phillip. Thank you everybody here joined today to stand up against the state's persecution of people sleeping rough. Some of you today have lived and living experience of homelessness, and it's your voices that hold the most weight and value. It's you mob whose lives are being impacted at the face of this, and whose lives will be impacted by the decisions that the council makes in this bougie colonial building behind us. What we're seeing happen right now in the inner city Melbourne suburbs is a calculated and coordinated attack on poor folks. If it feels like persecution of unhoused people is becoming more commonplace in Melbourne, that is not unintentional. What we're seeing happen with the alliance of the M9, the nine inner city Melbourne councils, including Port Phillip, Yarra, Stonington, Maribyrnong, Marybeck, Moonee Valley, Darebin, Hobsons Bay and Melbourne, is they're currently coordinating their agenda, including a focus on safer communities. But whose safety are they focused on? It's clear that people experiencing homelessness are not considered as part of the community whose safety they're interested in protecting, because the solutions proposed by these inner city councils are all focused on punishing poverty and actively dismantling the safety strategies of people who sleep rough, while stoking resentment and even violence against unhoused people by stigmatising these communities. Fortunately, while homeless people across Melbourne are facing a ramping up of criminalisation, stigma and persecution, we're also seeing a wave of community resistance take place, which we're all part of by showing up today. In St Kilda, the street-based sex worker community that I have contact with and delivering weekly outreach at Vixen, the majority of whom I have contact with are forced to sleep rough in St Kilda. They've spoken of escalating violence from ugly mugs, as well as disgusting local residents who come down to the streets in St Kilda, specifically with the intention to harass and abuse the unhoused street-based sex worker community in St Kilda. People sleeping rough more broadly have been subject to horrific violence in St Kilda, with one man even being set on fire last year. On top of these blatant forms of violence, there's also the insidious violence from the state in our city and throughout these cities through new proposed legislation that just passed last Wednesday by the City of Port Phillip, who were escalating their persecution of unhoused members of the community to pander to a vocal minority of malicious residents, traders and homeowners backed by St Kilda cops. Yay! The local law change that City of Port Phillip passed last week gives more powers to the council's local law officers to harass, move on, and confiscate belongings of unhoused folks. It's going to create devastating outcomes for street-based sex workers and all other people who sleep rough in that city due to a lack of affordable, suitable, available homes and crisis accom. Despite all of us working hard from last December till now to ensure the voices and concerns of people sleeping rough was amplified in so many different ways to council, it was gutting when the council voted against these voices of lived experience, against the voices of the orgs and the will of the community, and instead voted for the worst possible outcome for the community. The amendment they voted in involves much broader definitions than their original draft plan, meaning it will negatively impact even more unhoused people than we originally feared, with a policy, yeah, that's going to involve move-ons under a different name, confiscation of essential belongings that are being stigmatized as encampment equipment, and a new police protocol that they've voted in, which recommends the cops start joining the local law officers on daily joint patrols. We know that when communities who face intersecting marginalized identities come in greater contact with cops, especially mob, what we see an increase in police harassment, abuse, and even an increase in black deaths in custody. Things are already really bad with the current council policy and legislation before the addition of any additional powers. Formalising the punitive approach that we're already seeing will embolden these local law officers. We're seeing here in City of Melbourne that when you give people more powers, they abuse them. And the cops that'll be coming along for the ride is going to go harder on this community that's already doing it tough. What they're doing now is putting a local law change in that affects areas where a person is on council land, a road or a footpath, is present with the apparent intention of sleeping or camping there, and in possession of what they call encampment equipment at locations where council believes a specific encampment is causing problems with amenity, health or safety. And when pushed to determine what the fuck that means, they refuse to give a definition. And we know when these definitions are slippery, when they're left up to a case-by-case basis, which is what the council's saying will happen, it's left down to the individual person that comes out, has those tense interactions with community, and they, whenever someone is given that level of ability to make judgments in a subjective way, they always come down worse on people who are the most marginalized. What we know from unhoused peers in Port Phillip, they've already shared with us their own dehumanizing experiences of being frequently moved on from council land, having their belongings already confiscated by invasive daily local law patrols with no explanation of how to get them back and no offers of assistance or alternative accommodations made. And when the council was pushed to speak to this, after we played the testimonies of many unhoused peers in St Kilda in the council meeting on Wednesday, the head of the local law officers denied that this has been happening at all. They said, my officers have not been confiscating any belongings, and they have. And the council looked shocked to hear that it was happening. We know it's been happening. It's been happening for years. They're waking people up at 7 a.m. They're telling them, move your encampment equipment, and that can include anything that gives shelter or warmth. That includes bedding. That includes cardboard. That includes a trolley. And if you leave your belongings for a second, whether to go get a feed, whether to go to the toilet, which they do not provide in City of Port Phillip, they can take your stuff. People have lost their medications. They've lost their ID, which is already so hard to get. And they're gonna lose a lot more when they formalize this punitive approach. And when pushed about why are they linking people's belongings being taken with targeting nuisance or antisocial behavior, the council admitted the intent is punishment. That is what the intent is behind this. They said, we already have adequate laws that give council powers to remove larger items like furniture, like mattresses, and we already have the powers to deal with antisocial behavior. But what we're hoping to do with this new legislation is to put the power in there that if we're not happy with people's behavior, we can take their items to punish them and change that behavior. That is absolutely disgusting. Absolutely, and that's what we're seeing as well, is it's mob who are being targeted. We're seeing people being pushed out of areas, and when they're using this stigmatizing language, calling people encampments, and now even one person with items of shelter can be considered labeled an encampment, We know that, you know, it impacts people's right to gather, and that impacts mob who have a cultural right to gather. When we raised the issue, when a homeless black fella, Queenie, raised the issue at the council's Q&A session and said, what about protection of unhoused First Nations people? They said, don't stress. We have a reconciliation action plan, and our local law officers have received cultural awareness sensitivity training. I'm sure all the homeless mob are gonna feel so reassured to hear that they're gonna do a little fucking acknowledgement of country before they steal your shit on stolen land. It's disgusting. Seeing, you know, I'm excited to hear from the Footscray folks about, you know, the win that they've had lately, because we need to keep coming together as a community and combating these council punitive approaches, these attacks on poor people. You know, we're so excited to hear about how they had their win. Hope is not lost. Even when they pass this council bullshit, we're learning more every day about how to come together and combat it. We're learning, you know, we're going to follow every pathway possible. In City of Port Phillip, they said that, you know, they're moving into new legal territory. We've seen in Moreton Bay Council up in Queensland that they have challenged their application of similar council local law legislation on the basis of violation of human rights. And this new local law change in Port Phillip is violating the human right to shelter. So we're going to see the way that it's implemented, and, you know, we're going to try to work with folks to try to push that this is breaching human rights charters and legislation. So there's so many pathways to us winning, and we're not going to give up hope. Thank you.
We're gathered on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people. I want to pay my respect to elders and warriors past and present, and especially to recognise the relentless resistance of First Nations peoples against the criminalisation of almost every aspect of their survival and resistance since the invaders arrived until today. My name is Shifra. I organise with Footscray Community Response, and I want to tell you a bit about what's been happening in Footscray. Thank you. Maribyrnong's demographics have been changing, and this has led to class war. Some in Footscray are suffering in very extreme ways. Many are sleeping rough, many are also racialised and so chronically over-policed. There is deep trauma and distress. Meanwhile, the newer, richer folk in the area feel uncomfortable having to witness others suffering, but they frame their discomfort as a safety issue. They loudly proclaim that Footscray Mall is too dangerous to walk through and that poor people are inherently dangerous. They argue, therefore, their presence must be eradicated. Last year, in response to this hysteria, Council introduced a trial of security guards. Footscray Community Response's evaluation found the private security guards committed serious assaults as well as widespread intimidation and harassment of poor people existing in public space. But it's not just Council doing the punishing and criminalising. Police have brought sniffer dogs and heavily armed squads through the mall. Last year, cops killed an unhoused man in Footscray. Shame! One business got intervention orders against homeless people who sleep in the mall, alleging, basically, they are bad for profits, meaning some of our unhoused neighbours have been arrested many times for daring to be in their own community. Shame! Council responded to FCR's campaign by saying they'll ditch security, but they sold us a lie. Behind the scenes, they've been pushing for increased cops in Footscray. So security guards are being replaced with heaps more cops to continue the same project of trying to make Footscray unlivable for certain people. All this does make Footscray unsafe for unhoused and marginalised people who are under constant surveillance and subject to ever-escalating carceral responses, criminalising their very existence. All these strategies to deflect blame from capitalism onto the people suffering the most must end. No more cops, no more security, no more councils stealing people's belongings, no more coercion and state violence. We demand communities based on solidarity and care. If you live near Footscray and want to get involved, please come and have a chat. Thanks.
Woo-hoo! You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and that was a couple of speeches from the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria's gathering outside Melbourne's Town Hall on Tuesday this week, amplifying community opposition to the City of Melbourne's plan to expand its community safety officer patrols, which have been shown to be violent and exclusionary against homeless people living in the CBD, in the next financial year. And first up, you heard from Rory of Vixen Workers, and then after that, you heard from Shifra of Footscray Community Response. And remember to find out about what Homeless Persons Union of Victoria are up to. You can follow them on Instagram, and that is Homeless Persons Union Vic.
And now we are joined by Yolanda Robson, Director of Young Workers Centre, joins us following their landmark campaign that brought an end to junior pay rates for workers aged 18 to 20 in retail, fast food and pharmacy sectors. We also discussed the ongoing fight to protect young people and young workers following this week's budget. Hi Yolanda, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Beautiful, thanks so much for having me.
Can you walk us through the campaign journey by Young Workers Centre to end junior wages? Why are junior rates a problem?
Yeah, sure. So let's start with sort of what junior pay rates actually are, because I think when people hear the term, they don't always really clock sort of like what's happening. So how junior rates currently play out in practice in this country is two people working the same shift, in the same role, doing the same tasks, same responsibilities. One is paid significantly less because of when they were born. So we get told that young people should earn less because they lack experience, that they might make mistakes as they're still learning on the job. Our argument has been, point me in the direction of an older worker, someone who's 30 years old, who's never made a mistake. Point us in the direction of a worker who'd be supportive of having their pay docked for every mistake they made at work. We believe that your wage is your compensation for your time and your effort and labour, and you should absolutely be paid a living wage for showing up and getting your job done. So what's happened historically is every time a young person looks at their payslip, the law is telling them you are worth less, not because of your output or your effort or showing up to work and getting the job done. You're just inherently going to earn less than the person beside you because of when you were born. This translates into $3 billion of wages not going to young people in employment. We already live in a culture that tells young people that their opinions don't matter as much, that their concerns are naive, and that they need to earn the right to be taken seriously. But at the Young Workers Centre, we talk to high schoolers every single day, and we are talking to the high schoolers who are working 30 hours a week, cash in hand, to help keep the lights on at home. We are talking to the 18-year-old apprentice who works from 6:30 to 2:30 and then 4 to 11 p.m. to support themselves whilst escaping an abusive family household. We are hearing that young people are getting ripped off left and right because they feel disposable, and they're being told by everyone that they are, and junior pay rates in this country have made that official and ingrained in our workforce. So in saying all of that, the Young Workers Centre, after speaking to thousands of young workers, we knew we had to push for this change and to get rid of junior rates for good, and we have made a step in the right direction with this win. And I would like to congratulate the SDA Union for the mammoth amount of work in bringing this forward to the Fair Work Commission, because it's a really fantastic step in the right direction for young people.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that and really putting how much work that young people do when they are working so much. And, you know, I really do relate to a lot of, what the young people that you were interviewing and having to, when I was, in high school, or I started working at 14 and having to work so many jobs just to, leave a terrible situation, or like people don't know what young people are going through. And imagine, if you were 30 years old and your pay got deducted for every single mistake you made.
It's a crazy, it doesn't make sense, right?
Absolutely.
Like making mistakes is not a young people problem. It's a human problem. Like it's okay to make a mistake, you know?
And absolutely. Yeah. And it's just because of their age, it's not on the merit that they're working and just having a level playing field. And I know that the campaign has made changes to junior pay rates to workers in fast food, pharmacy and retail industries. What are the new changes and what should we really know about them?
Sure. So, like I said, it's a step in the right direction, absolutely. So the Fair Work Commission, I'll put it into context. So previously, 18-year-olds in those industries were paid 70% of the full adult wage. And 19-year-olds, 80%, 20-year-olds, 90%, so on. So all of that staged waging, all of that gets phased out to 100, people aged between 18 and 20 will get 100% of the adult rate starting in December this year, but it's being phased in, and we don't have the full details on that yet. So it will take a full year, a full few years to take full effect. But what this means is that there's 500,000 young workers in retail, fast food and pharmacy, and they're going to get a real pay rise, and that's really significant. There are a couple of things to note about this decision. So the first thing is the Fair Work Commission put in a six-month rule. So to get the full adult rate, if you're 18 years old, you need to have been with your current employer for 6 months. I think the commission sort of included this to ease the transition for businesses. We've got a couple of concerns about this. So in retail and fast food, it's a heavily casualized workforce, super high turnover, relies on a pretty much a gig workforce as well. So that's the first concern, that you won't actually stay in the job long enough to see the wage you should be entitled to kick in. And the second thing is that these industries can be really highly exploitative, full of wage theft, harassment, unsafe working conditions. They're really high in fast food and retail. So to me, it's concerning that a young worker may be incentivized to stay in a crap workplace with the hope of getting a pay bump if they stay on for more than 6 months.
Absolutely.
And further than that, to us at the Young Workers Centre, we're concerned that young people may not feel empowered to speak up on dangerous or unsafe working conditions, because they know if they get in, an adversarial mood with their boss, they might miss out on that, really extra needed money on their pay slip. So the six-month rule, in our opinion, does nothing to address the current power imbalance of workers and bad bosses in this country.
I'm sure it's also not uncommon for, after some, so-called cheap young worker turns 18 and then their shifts start to get cut.
What a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
That's literally already happening with junior rates. There are places that just hire 16 and 17-year-olds, which, by the way, there's been no changes to 16 and 17-year-olds in those industries. They will still earn 40 or 50% on the adult rate.
Half for people from working age until 16, 17, 14, 16, 17?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously this only affects the 18 to 20-year-old pay rate. That only affects those three industries. We are still looking at some apprentices earning $11 or $12 an hour.
That's horrific.
This win is real, but it is one battle in a much longer stream of advocacy.
And just to wrap up, coming up to the end, what are you hearing in your work from young people and workers, given the current climate? It's basically, a cost of living crisis, NDIS cuts, it's really horrific for so many young people who can't move out, have to stay in terrible situations. What does it mean to, what are you hearing from young people?
Yeah, sure. So, I know this probably isn't exclusive to just young people, but the statistics show that we are the most exploited, we are the most likely to be injured at work, and we're exhausted. Young people are working harder than ever, often with multiple jobs, mostly casual, no security, and we're still falling behind. We know, and we've been saying over and over and over again, that the cost of living continues to outpace our wages for years, and young people are feeling that gap most acutely. We are hearing from people who are skipping meals to cover rent continuously, not a one-off thing, but several times a week, having to make the call between paying their bills or eating.
Yep.
There are people who can't make rent at all. But what I'm also hearing and seeing is that young people are sharp and smart and capable, and we need to look to things like the Fair Work Commission decision and look at all the advocacy and all the young people that stood up and gave evidence and advocated and pushed for change, because no hard-fought win was ever handed to us. We just have to stay organised. We have to stay loud with hope. We've got to just keep pushing for change.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for highlighting like the incredible advocacy of young people that we see across so many sectors. And for how difficult it is for young people, I mean, we've been covering the stop the closure of CoHealth, which is already really important. And, you know, from some of the participants that were in the rally, they were saying that for the first time in ever, they're seeing symptoms of like scurvy come up because people are not eating. Or people cannot even That's afford crazy. To eat. But it's
a ship disease. I thought we phased that out.
Yes.
No.
Yeah. That's like the level of dire straits it is for so many people across this country and this state particularly. And, you know, just finally with, you know, given this week's budget, is there anything you really want to highlight for young people who are listening, who are, might feel just really sad about what is happening?
Sure. So I guess just really quickly, this week's budget was framed about sort of being about intergenerational fairness. And whilst sort of the budget doesn't seem sort of super geared towards young people, there are sort of changes being made that will have an effect on, younger millennials, Gen Z. There's been the changes in negative gearing and capital gains tax reforms, and they are the most significant changes to the housing tax system in over 25 years. This won't fix the housing market overnight or even this year, but it means it's moving in the right direction because it's curbing the enthusiasm of investors, so people who already have money. It's curbing their enthusiasm to seeing the housing market in Australia as a commodity to invest and sit on and make their wealth go up in that. They actually will now be incentivized to invest their money in other things that might actually drive innovation in industries like climate action, business, whatever. So that's one thing to note. The other is that there are certain targeted measures for young people who are most at risk of homelessness. Ironically, it's a top-up payment to landlords that's designed to help young people on youth allowance access community housing. But that kind of tells you about the real problem, is that because youth allowance is so low and young people on youth allowance and ABSTUDY are living below the poverty line, landlords would rather give their community housing to a pensioner. So the sort of the crux of the problem is unchanged, but We'll see what happens with that, with landlords being incentivised to house young people. I think this budget, with the changes to negative gearing and the capital gains tax and the junior wages win, is telling us the same story side by side, is that progress is real, but it is a hard one and it is slow, and young people have had to fight and be really loud for every single inch of clawing back what's fair. Nothing's been handed to us. If you're a young person listening, know your rights at work. Wage theft is rampant in exactly the industries we've been talking about today. Yeah. And if something feels wrong, join your union, reach out to other co-workers or chat to the Young Workers Centre.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Yolanda. And we'll have information on how to find out more. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Bye. And that was Yolanda Robson, Director of the Young Workers Centre, joining us to discuss their landmark campaign that brought an end to junior pay rates for workers aged 18 to 20 in retail, fast food and pharmacy sectors, starting in December 2026, phased out over 4 years.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are just about to go to our next segment. Leela, take it away.
Yes. So last week, the High Court dismissed a legal challenge brought against the Albanese government in 2025, which contested the government's right to permanently exile refugees and stateless people to Nauru. To unpack the details of the Albanese government's arrangement with Nauru and the High Court decision this morning, we are joined by Human Rights Law Centre Associate Legal Director, Josephine Langbian. Good morning, Josephine.
Good morning, Leela.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So on the 12th of February in 2025, the Albanese government agreed to something called an interim third country reception arrangement with Nauru. And at that point, it was temporary, but it has now become more permanent. Can you explain what exactly that is and how it came about?
Yeah, of course. Essentially, what we're talking about are the series of secretive deportation deals that the Albanese government has struck with Nauru, under which they're attempting to permanently exile hundreds of people to Nauru on these 30-year visas. Now, all of this came about because a few years ago, the High Court of Australia decided that it was no longer okay for the Australian government to just lock migrants and refugees up in immigration detention indefinitely. So previously, people who didn't have visas but couldn't be returned to their country of origin, so for example, because they're refugees or stateless or yes, really unwell, those people were just left in detention for years on end with no way out. And so after the High Court decided that this was unconstitutional, the government was then forced to release people from detention. And so in total, since that High Court decision, there's been around 400 people released. But instead of just letting those people return to the community and move on with their lives, the government has tried relentlessly to get around the High Court's decision. So they've done all kinds of things. You know, they've subjected people to ankle monitors and nightly curfews until the High Court ruled twice that this was also unconstitutional. Yeah. They've placed people on bridging visas with dozens of conditions and introduced criminal penalties for breach of those conditions. But all of this wasn't enough for the Australian government. So last year they struck this deal with Nauru, as you said, under which Australia will pay an undisclosed sum of money. We understand that could be anywhere between a few hundred million and $2.5 billion to Nauru for allowing Australia to deport people who have been released from indefinite detention to Nauru. And so this is ripping people away from their families, their kids, their lives, and sending them to a country that they have no connection to, where they don't speak the language, where their personal safety may be at risk. And so we believe that 9 people have already been sent to Nauru, but dozens have been fighting their deportation since this deal was announced, including through a series of legal challenges, and that's why this particular case that we're talking about today was before the High Court.
Yes, thank you for that explanation, Josephine. So we're really talking about the government spending hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially on actually not caring for people. And some of these people, like the person known as TCXM, who's at the centre of this case that we're talking about today, TCXM versus the Minister for Immigration and Citizenship, has actually been here since 1999, I think, and been a part of the community for so long, and is now getting permanently exiled to Nauru. So this very clearly seems inhumane, but what exactly were the challenges brought against the Albanese government in this case?
So this case raised a few different arguments. I won't dive into all of them, but the key part of this case was really about the limits of the government's power to deport people to places where they're likely to suffer serious harm. So this question of, like, what is going to happen to someone after they are deported somewhere?
Yes.
Now, we know at the Human Rights Law Centre and at the other, like, frontline services who are working with people in this situation, we know that many people who are facing deportation to Nauru have really serious physical and mental health conditions. A lot of people have disabilities. The things that they need specialist care for that they won't be able to access in Nauru. You know, the past decade of regional processing and offshore detention in Nauru has shown us that Nauru simply doesn't have the medical capabilities to provide the care that people need. You know, refugees previously sent to Nauru by the Australian government have died preventable deaths because they didn't have access to the medical care they needed.
Yes.
But under this deportation deal, the Australian government just doesn't have to even think about any of this. It doesn't matter. You know, there's no opportunity for people to explain why they couldn't survive on Nauru or why they shouldn't be sent. So the question for the High Court in this case was really whether the government's deportation powers allow them to send people to places where they're likely to face death or serious harm after they're deported. Now, that's separate to the question of whether someone has a refugee claim against a particular country. Mm. We're talking about, like, different types of harm, such as medical neglect. But, of course, another difficulty with this deportation scheme is also that people don't have any opportunity to explain if they do have refugee claims against Nauru. This case was really considering the limits of those deportation powers.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting that although many of the people facing deportation to Nauru already have recognised claims against their countries of origin, which probably aren't Nauru, they can't contest the decision to be deported to Nauru unless they have another recognised refugee claim against Nauru itself. So this is, I guess, suggesting that people might have to have multiple refugee claims, which just seems really unrealistic when you're already potentially in an appeals process. And
I mean, it's unrealistic, but it's also, almost legally impossible because the government's not giving people any opportunity to even make that refugee claim against Nauru. There's a lot of reasons that people might be at risk of persecution in Nauru, including because of all of the media reporting that has gone on about people in this situation. They're going to be very, very identifiable once they're removed. But the government has created these laws that essentially excuse them from ever having to really grapple with the consequences of what they're doing to people.
Yes, absolutely. And we really saw that solidified in the High Court decision. Josephine, can you just explain a little bit about the basis of the High Court's dismissal and what that could mean for people who are currently facing deportation or already in an appeal process?
So, unfortunately, the High Court decided that the government doesn't have to consider what happens to a person after they're deported from Australia. So as long as the government can actually carry out the deportation itself, then that's the end of the story. And what happens next is not a problem for Australia. What this means is that the Australian government can continue deporting people to Nauru despite life-threatening health risks. We're really concerned that for some people, deportation to Nauru could well be a death sentence.
Yes. But
as you pointed out earlier, you know, health risks are only part of the equation here. There's dozens of people who are facing deportation who actually have Australian citizen partners. Over 100 over 100 people have Australian citizen kids, and many of them have lived here for decades. And instead of allowing people to return to their lives, reconnect with their families after years in detention, the government is really intent on permanently exiling people to Nauru.
Yeah, and not to mention that a lot of these people have... They've been previously detained, a lot of the people that are facing deportation now, and are in the process of recovering from being detained and have injuries related to their time.
Exactly. I mean, being indefinitely detained for years on end has really serious impact on people's health. And so, yeah, exactly as you said, a lot of people have been released from detention after this High Court decision and are in the process of trying to recover from the trauma of those years, trying to get their lives back on track, and the government is intent on disrupting that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to wrap up today... how might members of the community without legal resources take action against this unjust and inhumane deportation process that will really cause ripple effects of harm in the community?
That's a great question. I think for anyone who thinks this is wrong, you know, I would urge you to speak up about it. I think the law is only going to take us so far with this. As this recent court decision shows, I think it's going to require community pushback to stop this. We saw the way that communities across the US have stood up to ICE and immigration raids happening there. But I think a lot of people here just simply don't know that such similar things are happening here. You know, Border Force officers are snatching people from their homes and detaining them and deporting them. So, you know, I would urge people, talk about this with your friends, your family, write to the Immigration Minister, Tony Burke, write to your local MP, tell them, you know, that you refuse to allow our government to subject migrants and refugees to harsher treatment and punishment simply because of their visa status. You know, tell them that you think that everyone should have the same right to live in dignity and safety, regardless of where they're from. If you're not comfortable doing this alone, like, join your local refugee advocacy group. Or if advocacy isn't for you, maybe there's time or money or resources you can donate to support the organisations who are working with people in this situation.
Yes, thank you so much, Josephine. And, yeah, I think it's really important to remember that this is not... we will not be told by the Australian government that this is someone else's problem that's relegated to, like, a different part of... our community here in so-called Australia. Like, these are people that actually have community ties here. And regardless of that, you know, we all deserve these human rights that these people are being denied. And yeah, we need to step up and make sure that this is known. So thank you so much for sharing your insight and information this morning, Josephine. It's been really good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye. We just heard from Human Rights Law Centre Associate Legal Director Josephine Langbian, who joined us this morning to unpack the details of the Albanese government's secretive arrangement with Nauru and the High Court's decision to dismiss a legal challenge brought against the government contesting their right to permanently exile refugees and stateless people to Nauru on 30-year visas. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Rally to save public housing. Over 10,000 residents are set to be displaced, with 6,660 homes to be demolished across 44 public housing towers. All this in an ever-worsening housing crisis. Join us at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 30th of May at 11 a.m. and then march to the Atherton Gardens public towers in Fitzroy as we fight to save the towers, people's homes and the communities in and around them. After the rally will be a community festival at the towers. The Victorian Labor Government is determined to demolish and privatise public housing and sell off public land to developers. See you on Saturday 30th of May. Together we can stop this madness. Save Public Housing Collective is a 3CR supporter.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:15 in the morning. And we're now going to our final interview for today, where we're joined by Shirley, who is co-convener of No AUKUS Victoria and the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition Working Group. And Shirley is going to be discussing some updates in the campaign against the Trilateral AUKUS Security Partnership, including the establishment this year of an Australian Federal Police Command tasked with targeting anti-AUKUS protests. Shirley's also going to talk to us about AUKUS-related expenditure in the 2026-2027 federal budget and about an upcoming webinar organised by the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition on Wednesday, the 20th of May at 6:30 p.m. And this webinar, moderated by Kelly Tranter and featuring a range of expert speakers, will unpack the dangerous world of the AUKUS Pact, US military occupation and the local suppression of dissent. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning, Priya.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you about this Australian Federal Police AUKUS Command. I believe it was established or announced in February of this year, but can you tell us about its origins and also its relationship to this broader atmosphere that we've seen over the past few years in particular of silencing dissent?
Right, yes, thank you. So this the AUKUS Command unit within the Australian Federal Police is something that was really discovered by former Senator Rex Patrick through his meticulous research of the Freedom of Information. Now, this unit was set up, it was quite secretive. This unit was set up at the end of last year, and he actually discovered it in January of this year. So it has been something that obviously has been worked on by the government, by the AFP, and no doubt by the AUKUS, people in the US, because this AUKUS command is also established in the UK. So they both are obviously, we presume that there's something very similar in the US, but they do arise in response to growing public opposition to AUKUS and nuclear submarines. And so, you know, there are various factors. There's the extraordinary high cost of nuclear submarines, which will blow out to $400 billion over the next 30 years. That's $35 million a day. That's $10 billion a year. And at a time of crisis in the rising cost of living, and, you know, I don't need to go list all the underfunded public health, NDIS slashes, the childcare, the, you know, the housing. And there's other, and there's more concern about Australia's deep integration into the US war machine and the military-industrial complex and compelling Australia or Australia's participation in US wars of aggression. Then there's the concern about the nuclear waste on the traditional owners' land and nuclear accidents and emissions and obviously the tightening of the US-Australia alliance. So there's a really visible and palpable opposition, and we've really depicted this just in the last 12 months to AUKUS, and it's quite it's growing and it's quite broad. So the establishment of the AUKUS command as part of the, well, it was an AUKUS command unit within the AFP, and mind you, it's jointly with the ADF, with the Australian military. So it's a joint command run by the AFP together with the ADF. So it is always a response to that growing opposition. And I should say that apart from Northern Territory, every other state in Australia has an anti-AUKUS coalition or anti-AUKUS activist group. Mm. And they're particularly strong. Well, they're strong in all those states. It's not surprising that this command has been established, particularly in the context of the growing attacks on generally on democratic rights, which have sort of become much sharper since the massive concern and opposition against the genocide in Palestine. So there's a lot of people are making connections. Dots are being linked, much more. And it is part of that overall attack on what the general public, you know, a lot of people are moving towards questioning the current status quo with the way that the government is dealing with the US or being so complicit with the US in genocide, but also complicit with the US in upholding the US global rules-based order, which is basically hegemony.
Yeah.
So the AFP, AUKUS command, is obviously there to suppress public protest. And it's also used as an undercover for anti-terrorism, which is a very wide net.
Mm.
So, you know, the sort of the blurb that's coming out about this command, the AUKUS command, is about, you know, safety of the public and about the terror, the anti-terror, you know, measures being taken against terrorism. And the draconian anti-terror laws introduced in 2003 will now be implemented against people protesting against AUKUS and nuclear submarines. And I think people are aware that those anti-terror laws introduced in 2003 are pretty draconian, are very wide. But these laws that now are being sort of implemented under the AUKUS command will also be extended to protests against US military installations in Australia. And among its so-called public order management is the use of tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets and firearms. And just to bring it right home to Victoria, is that recently there were Black Hawk exercises over Melbourne Port. And the black people might be aware, Black Hawk helicopters, they're military, they're used in military activities. Now, their blurb has come out, their blurb said, this training enables our aircrew to practice operating over water, around watercraft and in densely populated locations. Both the maritime and urban environments present unique challenges. So it's obviously they're doing these exercises with West Australia, South Australia and Wollongong or Port Kembla or Newcastle in mind as areas where the submarines will be based, and they're expecting opposition.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly insidious that they are, you know, just the idea that they are doing these exercises over densely populated areas, you know, makes you think about the kinds of horrible things that they could be preparing to do as part of this alliance. And so I did want to ask a bit more about the integration between Australian defense priorities and the United States and about the increasing U.S. military presence in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's really been growing since 2010 when Obama came out here and Hillary Clinton and standing next to Fawning Dillard had announced, this was the first public announcement, announced America's pivot into Asia Pacific, military pivot into Asia Pacific, which would see 60% of the US military that was based overseas outside America would be relocated to Asia Pacific, with Australia hosting over 2,500 permanently stationed Marines. And since that time, and then in 2014, the announcement of the Force Posture Agreement, which basically opened up all of Australia to US military installations. So we've got in Northern Territory around Darwin, we've got Tyndall Air Base, which has been expanded quite dramatically to host B-52 nuclear weapons-carrying bombers, which are regularly going to be hosted there. There's an increase in the military troops. There's the, obviously, Pine Gap. There's the Northwest Cape. And all this Australia's military facilities are now open to the US. And some of them actually will be controlled by the US. And all that is in that force posture agreement, which is quite a lengthy document, but it really shows how deeply Australia is now being integrated willingly by the successive Australian governments, I should say, willingly and, you know, enthusiastically into the US military machine.
Yeah.
And that military, US military machine is extended even the US military footprint is extended beyond the bases, but it actually goes into the economy where most of our manufacturing industries now are weapons, a multinational weapons corporation. That's where most of our manufacturing is.
Yeah, it's extremely, extremely concerning, Shirley, thinking about the level of integration and also just the availability now of sites on Australian soil to US military personnel. And I did want to ask, just because we have to wrap up in a couple of minutes, whether you could very quickly mention a little bit about the event that's coming up and if you wanted to make any comments on budget expenditure on the AUKUS partnership.
Sure, sure. So the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition, we're organising there will be a webinar on the 20th of May, 6 o'clock, and it's titled The Dangerous World of AUKUS and US Military Occupation, Confronting Laws, Suppressing Protest, Speech and Action. The event will be emceed by Kelly Tranter. Kelly is a democratic rights lawyer. She's very well known. She's very much involved in supporting campaigns against the US militarization of Australia. The other speakers will be Rex Patrick, who's the one who's discovered this secretive AUKUS command. Nick Hanna. Nick Hanna is probably people are aware. Nick is the defence or criminal defence lawyer in New South Wales who's been representing the protesters who were attacked by the police last February in the Palestine Solidarity Rally. Arthur Roras. Arthur is the secretary of the Southeast Trades and Labour Council in New South Wales, and he'll be talking about the Peace's Union business and the work that the unions are doing with the community in Wollongong. And David Shoebridge, which will talk in much more detail about the implications of this AUKUS command. The other person will be Jorgen Doyle. Jorgen is an activist at Pine Gap and Northern Territory, and he'll give a brief description of the militarisation of Northern Territory. But there will also be a very short presentation by activists on the ground campaign from West Australia, South Australia, Wollongong, and also Newcastle. So yeah, it'll be a very informative, and it won't be just a talking fest, because there will be proposals, recommendations of how we develop the movement against the laws, obviously.
Yeah.
But also to defy the laws.
We'll have information about how to register in our show notes. And unfortunately, Shirley, we've got to wrap up now, but that was really informative. And we'll link to the Anti-AUKUS Coalition so that people know where to tap in and how they can find out more. Thank you so much.
So we have got a website, and we also have a Gmail account, AAAC Gmail account.
Amazing.
Thank you for putting me on.
No, thank you. And that was Shirley, who's the co-convener of No AUKUS Victoria and the Australian Anti-AUKUS Coalition Working Group. And Shirley joined us to talk about some updates in the campaign against the AUKUS partnership, about the AFP command targeting anti-AUKUS protests, and also a bit about this upcoming webinar, which will unpack those issues further. Now, that's about all we have time for in today's show. But before we let you go, Inez, was there an update you wanted to share?
Yes. For people who want to join the Save the Community Health campaign, there is a Fitzroy Town Hall meeting today, 5:30, Thursday the 14th, Fitzroy Town Hall, Napier Street.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And we will catch you next week on Thursday Morning Breakfast, 3CR 855 AM. But for now, stay tuned for Lost in Science.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.